tastes that her merchandise is good. In other words, she learns from experience. Now, merchandise doesn't just mean possessions, but it means her products or her gain or profit, the product of her labors. She's a person of quality. She produces quality. She appreciates quality. She knows that you don't save money buying cheap. In many cases, you save money by buying what isn't cheap. As Mr. Armstrong illustrated in The Plain Truth about that Rolls Royce he bought and drove it for all those years and then made money on it when it sold it. And you know, we ran tests years ago. The cheapest car for ministers to drive back then was a Cadillac. But nobody dared do that, you know. Everybody just said, boy, that's some rich church and all their preachers drive Cadillacs. You know, nobody to say, well, that's the cheapest car to drive, really, if you consider all factors, which they did. You know, they literally checked that all out, and the cheapest car would have been a Cadillac, but nobody would have dared driven it. So instead, we followed the scripture, and God visited everybody in their fury. So, anyway, going on from there, her candle goes not out by night. In other words, by the time the sun goes down and the lights go on, she's still busy. Now, of course, in the Bible, the extinction of the lamp was a sign of calamity, while in a prosperous household, there would always be a light burning. So we've read some scriptures about their lamp going out in the suggestion of extinction or despair or poverty, like Proverbs 13:9. Job 18:6 is another verse that says the same thing, or Jeremiah 25, verse 10. So it's suggesting the light of this house is always burning, that there's going to always be prosperity and success there and not calamity and failure. Okay, verse 19. She lays her hands to the spindle and her hands hold the distaff, just showing one of her major responsibilities is keeping people well clothed. Now, it may be in our day that it's cheaper to buy already made garments than it is to make them because of the factories and the equipment and things like that. So, I don't know beans from apple butter about that. So, if you've got questions about that, you have to ask some of the women. Ask my wife about that. You know, one of the books that is put out on marriage has a section in there where it asks men what things cost that women buy, and it asks women what things cost that men buy, to make you realize you can't criticize your mate till you really know what they bought. And, you know, when I read through that list, I probably made the sorriest score anybody that ever took it, because I despise shopping, and I don't ever shop. My wife has to drag me down even to get suits, but, you know, I don't know, I don't have any idea what a turkey costs. I might go get a turkey for Thanksgiving and think I'm going to buy one for $12. Now, maybe I will. I don't even know whether I will or not. You probably do, but I... But it's a good test to take sometime. But it does show how she's willing to be responsible for the clothing. She stretches out her hand to the poor. Now, in some cases, there isn't the continuity in this 22-verse outline, but in order to make it alphabetized, it jumps back and forth. So verse 19 talks about laying her hands to the spindle and her hands holding the distaff, and later on it comes back, verse 21, and talks about how her household is clothed. Instead of those two verses being together, in order to make it alphabetized, they have to split them with another verse. But it shows the emphasis on being able to memorize parts of the Bible that are alphabetized. And I think one of the most neglected books in the whole Bible is the most alphabetized book in the whole Bible. And that's the book of Lamentations. Maybe you never noticed that. But what part of Lamentations, the first chapter, has 22 verses, perfectly alphabetized? Yeah. And the second chapter has 22 verses. And the third chapter has 66 verses. There are three verses under each letter there, three Aleph, three Beth, three Gimels, and Dalets, and on down. Chapter 4 has 22 verses. Chapter 5 has 22 verses. That's kind of odd. Every chapter in there is a multiple of the Hebrew alphabet. Now, why would God ever want anybody to... Do you remember the last time you read the book of Lamentations? It's probably been a long time ago. But you know what it pictures? The guy that didn't go to the place of safety, that got left behind and saw all the calamity that happened. And maybe we ought to memorize that, and we won't be there. Because I'll guarantee you, the guy's going to lament when he wakes up and finds out the Philadelphian church finished its job and it's gone to a place of safety and he didn't get included among them. He's going to lament. And it's going to be more than five chapters worth. But there's a whole book that's alphabetized to be easy to memorize. And there has to be a reason for that. God doesn't put the Bible together that way for no major reason. Well, back to verse 29, or 19, rather. She lays her hands to the spindle and her hands hold the distaff. She stretches out her hand to the poor. Yea, she reaches forth her hands to the needy. So when she stretches out her hand, she didn't just shake hands and say, "Well, God be with you." You know, she had something in her hand. She gave them, once again, of the product of her own thrift and industry and diligence. She was able to make more than just enough for her household and had quality things for sale. So she'd take the money that she had left over from what she'd earned and she'd give that to poor. Yea, she reaches forth her hands to the needy. Now here the Hebrew word poor is one of the different words. Hanai, H-A-N-I, is the word in this case. And this particular word means miserably wretched, very, very poverty-stricken. So it isn't suggesting she's taking over the husband's job of managing the third tithe or... she's doing his job of writing out the checks for the needy. But it does mean she's so moved by the wretched poor that she works extra to save just to be able to help those poor wretches. Yea, she reaches forth her hands to the needy. Of course, there's another different word. And the more you study the Bible, the deeper the meaning you get out of it. Now, verse 21. She's not afraid of the snow for her household. Now, snow is about as rare in Palestine as it is in Pasadena. But that even suggested something that might catch you off guard or be unanticipated. You know, you wouldn't need that verse if you're in Minnesota or North Dakota or Montana. You know, that would just go without saying. But where you're in Pasadena or Palestine, you wouldn't have to be afraid about getting caught off guard and all of a sudden having a hard freeze or a snowstorm hit and be unprepared. She's not afraid of the snow for her household. For all her household are clothed with, and of course here in the margin maybe shows you it means double garments, with scarlet. These are articles of luxury, which when they're made of wool are real warm and beautiful as well. So the Hebrew word literally means double garments. Now, some examples of this, Exodus 25 and verse 4, 2 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 24, or Jeremiah 4 and verse 30. These are examples of these double garments. Now, verse 22. Here again, she's going to be a woman that's cultured, well-dressed, dignified, and yet she's got a tender heart. She thinks about the poor. so she's not the typical society woman. You know, she's not some one that has to hobnob with the highbrows and be snooty and the wealth goes to her head. So you don't find that kind of woman pictured here at all. That kind of a woman wouldn't even want to be caught around the wretched. And they certainly wouldn't reach forth their hands to the needy. She makes herself coverings of tapestry. Her clothing is silk and purple. Now the word here, coverings of tapestry, is literally talking about bedspreads and drapes, curtains, things like that would all be included in that terminology. Then when it talks about her clothing, so one's talking about provisions for the house, the other's talking about her own garments. Her clothing is silk and purple, or fine linen and purple. Of course, these are costly garments. The fine linen, the same Hebrew word, is used in Genesis 41 and verse 42, and Exodus 28 and verse 39. The Revised Standard Version terms this fine linen. And the word for purple here, that means luxurious or grand or real rich, high quality, like Exodus 26 and verse 7, or Exodus 27, verses 9 and 18. Now, after having described this segment here about the weather and the care for her household and her garments herself, if anyone has met these previous qualifications, then her family is going to be one that's known. It's not going to be a run-of-the-mill family. Her family is going to be respected because of this type of a woman in it. Her husband is known, distinguished, or prominent in the gates. Of course, that's the place where they assembled, where judgment was administered. Chapter 24, verse 7, we read about someone being known in the gates, or chapter 2, verse 22. So that's not the first time we've run into that. But her husband is distinguished and prominent among the elders. When he sits among the elders of the land, of course, Ruth chapter 4, verses 1 and 2 is another example of the elders of the land sitting where the judgment was ministered in this place of assembly. So these recognized leaders or judges of the community all got gathered together there. You might notice Judges 8, verse 14, or Judges 11 and verse 5. Those are other examples of the elders being gathered at the gates, rendering judgments. And now he comes back to manufacturing again. So it might seem a little bit disorganized and chopped up, but it jumped from garments to one thing, then back to the garments and the other thing, now back to garments again. Verse 24, she makes fine linen or linen garments, this time for sale though, sells it, and delivers girdles unto the merchant. So here she doesn't only have enough for herself and her household, but she's able to sell some of her handiwork. Now, this term used here, this fabric of fine texture, is usually used either in a night garment or as an upper garment. And a couple of examples of this, Isaiah 3, chapter, we know what that's all about, verse 23. And then again, Judges 14 and verse 12. Now, when it comes to the word girdles, they're made of the same material that the fine linen is speaking about, but it's richly decorated. This term, girdles, you'll find in 1 Samuel 18 and verse 4, and 2 Samuel 18, verse 11. So here it's talking about, once again, real quality, and yet it's from her own making, and it's extra that she's made of quality for sale. Now, verse 25 comes back once again to strength and honor or dignity. So she appears strong and self-reliant. So she doesn't worry about the future. She's got security and the Hebrew term in the latter part of verse 25 literally means laugh at the future. Or in some cases it's talking about the last days even. The same terminology, time to come. Literally the last day. So she has security about her old age that she won't give up and die and lose this zest for life and this zeal for maintaining health and working and taking care of yourself. So that part is rather poorly translated in the end. She looks at her time of physical debility or death without anxiety. She can contemplate the future with cheerful expectation. She doesn't have to. She can laugh at her last days. She can relax and enjoy life and laugh in her old age. And if someone's lived that industrious and profitable life, they wouldn't have to look back with remorse and sadness. Now, verse 26. She opens her mouth with wisdom. In her tongue is the law of kindness. So maybe this is talking about her words of instruction to her children, are the words of wisdom she's given to her household and tempered that with good common sense. So she has a law of kindness that she's learned from exercising kindness, her instruction that she's gained from her kindly fruit or works. Verse 27, she looks well to the ways of her household. Now here again, the jumping back and forth for alphabetical purposes. Looks well literally means observes keenly. All that goes on, nothing escapes her attention. She's wide awake to her job. She's diligent in her home and with her kids. She can detect when they're down or upset or problems or troubles. That's what this term suggests. She doesn't eat the bread of idleness. In other words, she doesn't have time to gossip over the back fence or be a busybody running back and forth the neighbors blabbing. Verse 28, her children rise up and call her blessed or happy, same word. Her husband rises up, same verbs understood, and he praises her. Now, if people have a mother and a wife like that, that's that industrious and that healthy and that on top of everything and aware of everything and providing good, balanced, healthy meals, unless they're graceless wretches, they ought to rise up and call her happy and praise her. Now, verse 29. Many daughters or women have gotten riches or have done virtuously, have done valiantly. This is, once again, the same word that we ran into back in verse 10 to start with. So why they don't put it back in there, I don't know, because it leaves you without that reality. Because the word virtuous that came out of the Hebrew in verse 10 crops up again here. Many daughters have done virtuously. So he didn't say you can't find a virtuous woman. He's saying out of the many daughters who have been virtuous, or out of the many good wives, out of the many godly, healthy, diligent wives, you're number one. You're tops. You excel all of them. Now he comes back to the summary in the next couple of verses. Favor is deceitful, and beauty is vain. Now, there have never been any more opposites than that in our world, because if you just turn God's way upside down and backward, you get the way of the world. Favor is everything. Whatever you do, really be sure you dress to please everybody else and that you always maintain everybody else's favor. And one of the worst things you can do is to not be concerned about peer feelings and style and everybody else's opinion, because after all, favor's everything and beauty's everything. Well, that's just the opposite of what God says. And yet, if everybody took lie detector tests and was forced to tell the truth, you know what most people would come out with if they were speaking up with a lie detector on them? They'd say favor is important and beauty's everything. You know, the one woman that told Mr. Armstrong when the old decision was made years ago about makeup, she said, "Well, I'd rather be pretty any day than smart." Well, the sad thing was she wasn't either one. Well, she certainly showed she wasn't smart by what she said. Well, actually, the Hebrew word here, deceitful, is literally the word lie. Favor is a lie. Favor's a lie. When you do something to get somebody else's favor, what good is that going to do? If you had to do something to get their favor, they're not worth having. You know, if you had to knuckle under to their idea, if you had to conform to their style or their standard in order to gain their favor, who wants them? If people are that shallow that their favor to you all hinges on your conformity to their standards, their ideas, then nobody needs friends like that. Now, how about every day if you go about and you find yourself trying to gain the favor of somebody, God's Spirit plopped this verse back in your head again. And every day, every time during the day that you're tempted to be motivated to do or say something to gain favor, this word would flop up: favor is a lie. Favor's lying. Favor's deceptive. Fraudulent. It's deceitful. Then you'd forget about favor. And then you might gain favor then. Beauty is vain. I thought about that this morning when we had the Rose Queen's breakfast, you know. The Rose Queen from 1930 was there. The Rose Queen from 1932 was there. And she looked a lot older than the one that was from 1930. And then the one from 1954 was there. And I thought, boy, oh boy, favor is deceitful and beauty is vain. You know, the roses wilt and the roses age and the roses change. And, well, God is accurate, you know. Beauty is a curse. How many people has beauty been a curse with? I know the girl I thought in high school was the most gorgeous doll that was there. Come to find out later, everybody thought she was above them and nobody would ask her for a date because everybody was embarrassed about being turned down by this beautiful doll, you know. So she had the most lonely life about any girl in high school. Well, beauty is vain. You know, I kid a lot of ministers sometimes that, boy, it's great to be ugly. People talk about their ugly finder, you know, how it goes off when it gets around me. And, well, I'd rather be ugly any day, and it saves you a lot of troubles. You know, my wife was mostly blind in one eye, so I just stayed on that side of her all the time. Now, I'm mostly deaf in one ear, so I just sit with that ear her direction all the time. So there are some blessings for being ugly and half deaf, you know. But God is accurate in that verse when he says beauty is vain. Grace is, or favor is false. Blinds your eye. Leads to disappointment. Now notice some people have bad-mouthed Proverbs 31 saying, why, it's material, it's physical. All it does is talk about physical. Everything's on the physical realm. Well, that isn't really true. It talks about a heart that would work extra to stretch forth the hand of the wretched. It talks about what's under her tongue. It talks about the influence she has on her husband and her children, and their respect rising up and calling her blessed and praising her. And it really hits the one key you need, a woman who fears the eternal. That's all you need to say in the spiritual realm. If you find a woman who fears God, then she isn't going to reason with Scripture and say, well, yeah, I know it says that, but... Well, I really respected women that heard Mr. Armstrong in the Bible study about makeup, and he was talking how in Big Sandy he just spent a few minutes on makeup. But as soon as we got to Big Sandy, boy, you know, the first thing we heard, well, you know, Mr. Armstrong really dropped a bombshell on us. So what'd he say? Christ is already here, or the millennium's coming tomorrow, or, you know, I was anxious to find out what he said. He said, no, we can't wear this paint anymore. I thought, well, that's a bombshell. I wonder what he said the other hour and 30 minutes, because he didn't save it about 10 minutes worth. But boy, the trash cans the next day were heavy and hauled off full of cosmetics and makeup. Well, God says, a woman who fears the eternal. Now, I wonder how many men in their dating, and they say, well, I don't think I'll date that girl much more because she just totally caught up in looking for favor. And, well, you know, I'm not going to date that girl anymore. She's got the looks, but boy, she knows it. And she's going to get wrinkled when she gets older, and that's hard to live with if the beauty isn't the inside. Well, I'll tell you, here's a lady that fears God. If God says, wives, obey your husband, she fears God. And if God says, tithe and fast and study and pray, well, boy, here's a woman that does that. She may have a wart on her nose and be ugly as Abraham Lincoln, but, boy, it'd be great to be married to an Abraham Lincoln, wouldn't it? Imagine how much that would increase your position in God's kingdom to be married to somebody like Abraham Lincoln. People ask him sometimes about his ugliness, and he got over that, you know. He got to where that didn't bother him too much. Said, boy, your legs sure are long. How long do you think a man's legs ought to be? And he said, well, just as long as they reach the floor. Well, that's a pretty smart answer. Well, God summarized his opinion in verse 30. And then he finishes it off by just showing that you reap what you sow. So he says, give her of the fruit of her hands. In other words, repay her with your recognition and appreciation that she richly deserves. Let her own works praise her in the gates. So even in the same way that her husband is respected and famous in the gates, she is too. By her own words, she is praised by those same elders, by anybody else that's among the wise, the judges in the gates. So she brings right back on her own head the fruit of her own labors. So at any public gathering, they reflect appreciation and respect. Now, you know you do that when you read in the New Testament about Anna, or you read in there about Mary Martha, or you read in there about some of the other women. You know, one woman was so much of an influence that Christ said, anywhere this gospel's preached, you're to tell about her works. Boy, that's quite a testimony from Christ himself. Of course, the fact that he appeared to a woman, first of all, after he was resurrected, you know, that showed how much appreciation he had for the kind of woman that's pictured there in Proverbs 31. I hadn't thought we'd take that long on that, but come back to the Psalms again. Now we're back in Psalm 56. Of course, Mr. Kaplan's already covered 120 through 134, and we've covered all those that are millennial, so we don't really have that many to finish, so... Didn't I finish 55? I guess not. That's the one we're on, then. I couldn't remember whether we finished it or we're due on it. Okay. Psalm 55. Here again you have a psalm of David, or an instructive psalm of David. Give ear to my prayer, O God. Hide not yourself from my supplication. Now, when you've prayed and God doesn't seem to have answered, and you keep on praying and God doesn't seem to answer, then you go ahead and get a little bit more open and frank with God in this way. Attend unto me and hear me. Now, most people would never imagine you'd ever do that with God. Now, but how would you feel as a dad if your son had been trying to get through to you, and he hadn't been able to get through to you, and you were too busy, and you didn't have time, and you didn't take time, and things were important to him, and he was suffering and having a difficult time because he couldn't get through to you, and your son just said, give ear to me, Dad. Don't hide yourself from my requests. Attend to me and hear me, Dad. I mourn in my complaint. Make a noise. Now, you know, you wouldn't get angry at your son if he was doing that. You begin to say, well, say, wake up, Dad, what's the matter with you? You've been putting him off and not taking time and neglecting, and yeah, you know, you wouldn't get mad and give him a backhand or, you know, shout and yell at him, and you wouldn't do that. So God wants us to be persistent and diligent and, you know, remind God of what he said to do. You're not suggesting by that God's forgetting. You're just showing God, you know what he said he's going to do, and he's bound to do it. You hold God to his word, and you know what God said, and he can't lie. He's bound to do what he said. But that's just foreign to worldly prayer, you know. You never heard anybody pray like that till you came into the church. The first time I ever heard Mr. Armstrong anoint somebody, I was really scared. You know, I thought God might zap us there because we were telling him what he said and what he had to do, and I thought, oh boy, this, you know, I wish I was somewhere else. I was really worried and frightened. And then I was even more sure afterward, because this lady had the flu, and as soon as we stood up, you know, she just lost everything all over the floor, and my first thought was, it didn't work. But you know, she never did miss a service. It did work. It just didn't work the way I thought it was going to work. But it certainly worked. Well, God wants you to pray that confidently or that surely. God wants you to, you know, if your son comes up and says, but Dad, you promised. Dad, you can't. Well, Dad, you always done what you said. You got to do that, Dad, you said. Now, you don't get mad. You don't get angry. Well, God doesn't either, you know. God's a father to us like we are to our kids, far more. You know, God says, if we, being evil by nature, know how to give good gifts to our children, then how much more does God give the Holy Spirit to those that ask him? And, you know, it's even unbelievable when God goes further and says, if your son asks you for bread, will you give him a serpent? You know, you'd never do that. Even as carnal as you are, as human and worldly and hard-headed and evil as we are, if your son asks you for bread, you're not going to give him a serpent. And if he asks you for fish, you're not going to give him a rock. Well, then, why would you expect God to not give you the good things that he says in here when you ask him? So that isn't sticking your neck out to pray like this. Give ear to my prayer, O God. Hide not yourself from my supplication. Now remember, supplication is praying daily about one specific thing. Don't forget that word supplication. It's not just prayer. It's not double talk. Supplication is when you're so concerned about one specific thing that you pray about it every day, every day, every day. Maybe even fasting once a week about certain things. Don't hide yourself from my supplication. Attend unto me and hear me. I am worn in my complaint and make a noise because of the voice of the enemy, because of the oppression of the wicked. They cast iniquity upon me, and in wrath they hate me. My heart is sore pained within me, and the terrors of death are fallen upon me. So apparently he was really in a strait, really in persecution. The enemy's voice and the wicked oppressing and accusing him of iniquity and hating him in their wrath and worrying and sore pain and afraid he's going to be allowed to just go ahead and endure all this till he died. Fearfulness and trembling are come upon me. Horror has overwhelmed me. I said, oh, that I had wings like a dove. Then I'd fly away and be at rest. So he was actually wishing he could die. Just wish he could die and get it over with. Now, I used to never could understand anybody ever doing that. Until you, as you get older, and sometimes you're tempted to wish that and think that. I was talking to one of the ministers, you know, just in the last few months, and he was just saying, oh, you know, sometimes the burden gets so heavy and the troubles and things get so weighty, you just wish maybe God would let you die in a secure time when your reward would be assured you and just get to depart and be with Christ. Well, you know what else Paul said when he said that, though? For the people's sake, it was more needful that he be left around, so. Lo, then I would wander far off and remain in the wilderness. Or just get away from it all, you know. Take off and hide out off to yourself alone somewhere. But it's kind of hard to love your neighbor when you're out in an Arabian desert, you know. It's kind of hard to overcome and grow and build character when you are a character, you know, after all by yourself. That's bad company, you know. Think about that. And tie that in with what follows. I would hasten my escape from the windy storm and tempest. Boy, if God would just let me have my way, I'd just get out of here. I'd disappear, he's saying. Destroy, O Lord, and divide their tongues. Now he's getting a little bit angry, you know, getting a little bit upset and a little bit human here. So now he's beginning to ask God, swallow up, O Eternal, or O Lord, divide their tongues. I've seen violence and strife in the city. Day and night they go about it upon the walls thereof. Mischief also and sorrow in the midst of it. And maybe you feel that way after you read the L.A. Times every Sunday. You say, day and night, oh, I've seen violence and strife in the city. Mischief, wickedness is in the midst thereof. Deceit and guile depart not from her streets. It was not an enemy that reproached me. Now, of course, that's messianic prophecy about one of the disciples being the betrayer of Christ. Then I could have borne it. Neither was it he that hated me that did magnify himself against me. Then I would have hid myself from him. But it was you, the man according to my rank, my guide, mine acquaintance. Now, maybe whether this is talking about Absalom, his own son, or whether it's talking about Joab or one of his own men, you know, it could apply, and he could have said it several times about different men. So that's another thing that hurts so much. I'm sure Mr. Armstrong's prayed this prayer many a time. If it had been the world persecuting us for truth's sake, well, it would have been a different story. But it was someone of our own ranks, someone of our own leaders, someone who'd been a guide and acquaintance, someone that we'd taken sweet counsel together and walked to the house of God in company. So there's verse about going up the holy days, going into the temple. Let death seize upon them. Let them go down quick into hell. For wickedness is in their dwellings among them. Of course, he justified that. Well, I'd be better off dead. Just, God, won't you just let death seize on them? Let them go down quickly into the grave. As for me, I'll call on God, and the Eternal shall save me. So now, after that emotional outburst, now he kind of remembers God's assurance and promise, and you know, God just let David put his heart right in the Bible. So you may realize at times in your life you've gone through that very same cycle. Evening and morning and at noon will I pray. And that's one of the two places in the Bible that it mentions that. Daniel 6, verse 10 is the other one. So if you want to be a David or a Daniel, then you'll have to pray three times a day with their hearts as they did. So a lot of people set goals higher than they can achieve, and then they get frustrated and feel guilty. And you know, people talk about praying an hour a day, and I don't think you can prove that from the Bible. You can't clock your prayers by a clock anyway. I know some men, I remember we had a student, and he was the most praying student we had. Boy, every time I'd walk up and down the hall, he'd be coming out of the closet or coming out of the attic, and he'd been out praying. You know, he must have prayed every 30 minutes. Well, I figure I can make it an hour or two, you know, on prayer without having to pray every half hour. But that guy was, I don't know why he was that way, but after I graduated and went out to Missouri, I visited him in a mental institution. So you can't just log prayer time. You know, some people, it's as if God has a time clock up there, and you say, well, God, here I am punching in again, getting another hour in today. You know, that used to burn me up when Job's would come around, and they'd say, well, Dean, you got your hour in yet today? Of course, if I'd been praying 2 or 3 hours, it shouldn't have made any difference. It shouldn't have affected me any differently if they asked me. But, you know, it isn't a matter of logging time in prayer. It's just a matter of being God's real to you. And you talk to God as if he's a father. And you know God. You know the way he is. You know what he's written. You know, I remember a couple of ministers in the past said, well, if you ever come to the forced decision between studying and praying, pray every time. Well, I asked people in the churches one time for everybody to bow their heads, and I asked how many people had prayed a half hour a day that week and how many had studied a half hour a day. Twice as many had prayed as had studied. Now, in a sense, when you study, God's talking to you. And I'm afraid too many times when we pray, we're talking to God. Now, that isn't always true. A lot of times God talks to you in prayer, too. You may get up after prayer and jot down a whole bunch of things you thought of while you're praying. So God can talk to you while you're praying. You're not just talking to God the whole time. But I would think you're going to be a lot weaker if you don't pray, don't study as much as you pray, because you've got to know what God says. You know, this is God right there. That's the Word, the Logos right there. I think most of our problems are because we don't know the Bible as well as we ought to, not mainly because we don't pray as much as we ought to. I think if all of us prayed 3 times a day, an hour every day, and didn't study our Bibles, we wouldn't be in much better shape than we are today. Because if you don't know the Bible, you don't know God's Word. You know, God's Spirit calls for remembrance what you put in there. He doesn't put it in there for you. It doesn't cram it in there. Well, evening and morning and at noon, that's the ideal goal. But I've heard of some funny things at noontime when people try to pray at noon. You know, where they work, there isn't any way they can pray at noon except get off in the bathroom or get off in some other place, and somebody comes in on you and wonders, what on earth? Is this guy sick, or is he dead, or what's the matter with him, you know? And so maybe you're better off just pray as soon as you get in from work and then pray again before you go to bed.
it isn't that big deal. The clock strikes 12, but you know what the Jews did? They just like 10, 2, and 4 Dr. Pepper time, you know. They had the hour of prayer, 10, 2, and 4. Now, if you pray at 10, you ought to be able to make it past 12 without being too wicked, you know, or too off track. Well, it isn't the time you log, I'll tell you for sure. Cry aloud. That's a part of prayer. He shall hear my voice. He's delivered my soul in peace from the battle against me, because there were many with me. God shall hear and afflict them, even he that abides of old. Think about that. Connect these two statements on each side of that connector. Seal it. Because they have no charges, therefore they don't fear God. He has put forth his hands against such as be at peace with him. He's broken his covenant. So now he's telling the bad things about these persecutors again, and how they don't keep their word and they break their covenants. The words of his mouth were smoother than butter, but war was in his heart. So he's talking about politicians again. Frauds, liars, people that put on the dog outwardly and underneath. The Israelites were taking over the promised land, and one group heard about the devastation of others, so they sneaked in there and went to all the trouble to rough up their clothes and learn this dialect so they could act like they were from way off, you know, and they were neighbors. So they made this treaty with Israel, and they ended up being a thorn in their flesh. But they were just like these people here. The words of their mouth smoother than butter, but war was in their heart. Words softer than oil, yet they had their swords drawn. Cast your burden on the Lord. He'll sustain you. He'll never suffer the righteous to be moved. So now he's getting his confidence back again after he reflected back on these frauds and their persecution and their pressure on him. Now he comes back to confidence again. He'll never suffer the righteous to be moved. But you, O God, shall bring them down into the pit of destruction. Bloody and deceitful men shall not live out half their days. But I'll trust in you. Of course, you've never seen a violent, vicious, warring mongrel that lived to be 100 or 120 or 90 or 85. You know, a lot of other people do, but nobody like that. Now, here's another Psalm of David, this time when the Philistines took him in Gath. And here he cries out to God and says, "Be full of mercy to me, O God, because man would swallow me up. He fighting daily oppresses me. Mine enemies would daily swallow me up. They are many that fight against me, O you Most High. What time I'm afraid, I'll trust in you." So, you know, he's just talking himself into this confidence. In God I'll praise his word. In God I put my trust. I'll not fear what flesh can do to me. Oh, yeah, you just wait. Now, here he's on the positive. And now, every day they rest my words. So, they must have had newspaper reporters back then, too. All their thoughts are against me for evil. So if somebody's of that frame of mind, then everything you're going to say is going to be taken the wrong way. You know, Mr. Armstrong's been very wise in having the policy of not answering detractors, not answering persecutors. He has always had that policy. He has never gone out and sought interviews. Never, ever. I've been around him 30 years, and he's turned down many a chance to go on programs. Well, others didn't always have that same policy. Well, he was kind and understanding enough that if he put men in positions, you know, he'd let them use their ideas and their thoughts. And so men began to seek interviews, and look what it led to. You know, there's no way you're going to go on any 60 Minutes or any blab show and ever come out except What does God tell you if you cast your pearl before the swine? You know what's going to happen to you? You remember what it says. They'll trample them under feet and turn again and rend you. That's what always happens, too. You always come out the loser. Every day they rest my words. All their thoughts are against me for evil. They gather themselves together. They hide themselves. They mark my steps when they wait for my soul. Plotting, scheming, spying, looking. Shall they escape by iniquity? In your anger, cast down the people, O God. So, you know, David knew God was a God that could get angry. David knew God wasn't a pacifist and a pansy and some kind of a mealy mouse cotton candy God. Just a powder puff. God's a God of real character and real personality. God's angry with the wicked every day. So we don't need a psychologist God or psychiatrist God or some kind of a God like the world pictures. Now, in the same way that persecutors marked his steps, kept their eyes on him, he said, well, yeah, look at that, though God does too. Oh, yeah, God, I remember you tell my wanderings. And you put my tears into your bottle, and you record all that in your book. You got a book of remembrance up there, God. Bill Smith was persecuted today and was brought to tears before he recanted. No. Before they'd water down the truth, Betty Brown was persecuted by her husband today and brought to tears. God puts all that in his bottle. Don't think he doesn't. That's not symbolic language. That's not figurative speaking. That's literal. Psalm 69, verse 3 tells you that again. Malachi 3, verse 16 is about that book of remembrance, if you want to put that in there. God writes all that in your records. When I cry to you, then mine enemies will turn back. This I know, because God is for me. In God I'll praise His word. In the eternal I'll praise His word. So these two psalms are the kind that you need to read aloud on your knees when you're going through these ups and downs of disgust and anger over persecutors. And then you remember God. Then you have faith in God. Then your mind goes back on these persecutors. Then you get back thinking about God again. So these are good psalms to remember for that use. In the eternal I'll praise His word. In God I put my trust. I'll not be afraid what man can do to me. Your vows are upon me, O eternal. I'll render praises to you. You've delivered my soul from death. Now that wouldn't be needed if it's immortal. Won't you deliver my feet from falling, that I may walk before God in the light of the living? Now another one that ties right in here, when he was fleeing from Saul in a cave. Another one of David's melodies. Be full of mercy to me, O God. Be full of mercy to me, because my soul trusts in you. Yea, in the shadow of your wings I'll make my refuge, until these calamities be passed over. Now, that's another verse you could very easily take to mean a place of safety, and I've got Petra written right after it. I'm not going to erase it. The shadow of God's wings. Boy, that's mentioned many a time. How about Deuteronomy 32, verse 11? Talking about the shadow of God's wings being the shelter for people. What about Exodus 19 and verse 4? Matthew 23, verse 37. Again in Ezekiel 5, about verse 5. In the shadow of your wings I'll make my refuge, until the calamities are past. That's repeated again in Isaiah 26, verse 20. I'll cry to God Most High, to God that performs all things for me. He'll send from heaven. He'll save me from the reproach of him that would swallow me up. Think about that. Blend that over with what follows. God shall send forth his mercy and his truth. You might remember back in Revelation 12, it talked about Satan casting out of his mouth the waters of a flood that they might swallow up. So here, after talking about God sending from heaven,
and saving you from the reproach that would swallow up. He uses the word Selah, Petra, rock. God shall send forth His mercy and His truth. My soul is among lions. So He likens other world leaders, like God did, to lions. I lie even among them that are set on fire. The sons of men, their teeth are spears and arrows, their tongues a sharp sword. So don't ever believe that satanic proverb about sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never harm me. God said, the sons of men, their teeth are spears, arrows, a sharp sword. Be you exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be above all the earth. They've prepared a net for my steps. My soul's bowed down. They've digged a pit before me. Into the midst whereof they're fallen themselves. That old proverb we read last time. He that digs the pit shall fall therein. So be careful if you're a pit digger, because you're digging for yourself. Think about that. Selah. My heart is fixed, O God. My heart is fixed. I'll sing and give praise. Awake up my glory. Awake, psaltery and harp. You know, you ever talk that way to yourself, you know? Motivate yourself. Stir yourself to action. Get after yourself. Douglas MacArthur used to do that at West Point, and he'd hear everybody out playing ball and goofing off and wasting time, and he'd long and desire to be out there with them and go to the window and look out, and then he'd make himself go stand in front of the mirror on the door and give himself a good chewing out. So you came here to study. You're spending your good money here. Remember how hard that money was to earn? You're not going to blow that money goofing off down there playing ball. This is not a... And this is real. It's not playing. Now you get over there and sit down at that desk and you get to study. He just literally do himself that way regularly. Tell yourself that inwardly. People catch you doing that too much outwardly, you're liable to be suspect, you know. But here David says, awake my glory, awake psaltery and harp, wake up, quit sleeping, Christian. Awake. Where's the glory? Awake, you know. Where's the joy and the praise for the God? I myself will awake early. I'll praise you, O Lord, among the people. I'll sing to you among the nations. Your mercy is great to the heavens, and your truth is great all the way to the clouds. You be exalted, O God, above the earth. Verse 5 is repeated exactly in verse 11. Let your glory be above all the earth. Now, you know what else? This verse 7 through 11 is also added on to two other psalms. It's added on to Psalm 60 in verses 5 through 12, the exact same verses. So these exact same verses are in Psalms three times. Psalm 108, same thing exactly. So there must be real importance for that when God triples it, puts it in your Bible three times. My heart is fixed, O God. My heart is fixed. I'll sing and give praise. Wake up, my glory. Awake, psaltery and harp. I myself will awake early. I'll praise you, O Lord, among the people. I'll sing to you among the nations. Because your mercy is great to the heavens. Your truth's great all the way to the clouds. You be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be above all the earth. And we won't read Psalm 108 when we get there then. We just read it. And that's the last part of Psalm 62, so we'll skip that as well. Go on then to Psalm 58. Here's the golden one of David again. Of course, the to the chief musician goes at the end of Psalm 57, as we've known from earlier studies and the examples of Lamentations and Habakkuk. So here he says, do you indeed speak righteousness, O congregation? Do you judge uprightly, O you sons of men? Yea, in heart we work wickedness. You weigh the violence of your hands in the earth. The wicked are estranged from the womb. They go astray as soon as they be born, speaking lies. Now, that doesn't mean
children are born with human nature, but it means before you'd ever even believe it, Satan pumps carnality into kids. That's really what he's saying there. Maybe hereditary traits are there even in kids. In some cases, they may inherit a nature that leads them to crime or leads them to bad temperament or bad future troubles. It's one of the risks you take when you adopt. That's why Mr. Armstrong's always said that adoption shouldn't be done if it's a lack of faith. If it's done out of charity toward some relative or friend that were killed in an accident, and you just jumped in to help fatherless children, that's another thing. And again, the boss always said that names shouldn't be changed. Children ought to always bear their dad's name. And just changing names isn't right unless the dad is some kind of a real degenerate wretch and agrees to have his own flesh and blood descendants' names changed. You know, that's what the church has always taught, and it's never changed that. Now, some people haven't abided by that. That's their problem. But I heard Mr. Armstrong say just a couple of weeks ago that people shouldn't be changing children's names. They have the right and they have the responsibility to carry on the name of their dad. In the Old Testament, a man even had to marry his brother's wife in order to maintain a name. Name's mighty important, you know. Well, the wicked are estranged from the womb. They go astray as soon as they be born. So if you disagree with Mr. Armstrong about human nature being pumped into babies almost from the time they're born, you hadn't been around. You hadn't had any yet. You know, you have children and you watch them. From the time they're very small, they're selfish and, you know, they're carnal and they don't think about dad and mom, you know, they don't think about anything at all except self. Well, they have to be taught. Now he goes on showing how they just start off almost as soon as they're born and it goes on and worse. Their poison is like the poison of a serpent, and like the deaf adder that stops her ear, which won't hearken to the voice of charmers, charming never so wisely. So there's some snakes you can charm. You don't want to try that on a rattlesnake. You can play that flute all you want till he bites you. You know, you're not going to tame any rattlesnake. Now, if you want to hypnotize a cobra, well, that's a little different story. Break their teeth, O God. Surely that can't be right. That must be a mistranslation, or we got into the wrong book all of a sudden. Well, you know good and well you felt that way sometimes, carnally, and God made David put it in print. So you'd hate to have to put all of your thoughts in print. You know good and well, if God in the millennium flashes up the plain truth about Dean Blackwell, boy, I hope I'm somewhere else and he does that. And reveals every feeling. That's going to be a sad day, you know. God isn't going to do that. You know, he's forgotten it, removed it as far as the east is from the west. Well, David, in his humanity, asked God, break their teeth, O God, in their mouth. Listen to those big mouths. Listen to what they're lying. Listen to their words. Well, God, why don't you just put your fist in their mouth and shut them up? Break out the great teeth of the young lions, O Eternal. So now he's talking about leaders with their braggadocio big mouth like young lions. Let them melt away as waters that run continually. When he bends his bow to shoot his arrows, let them be as cut in pieces. Shoot himself in the foot. You know, let his arrows break instead of going out. Like a snail that melts when you put salt on them. Let every one of them just dissolve, disappear. Like the untimely birth of a woman, that they may not see the sun, an abort or a miscarriage. Before your pots can feel the thorns, he shall take them away as with a whirlwind. In other words, melting pots, that thorns were especially hot heat, quick heat.
so swift, quick heat from thorns under a melting pot. That's how quickly God will take away, like with a whirlwind, both living and in his wrath. The righteous shall rejoice when he sees the vengeance. He'll wash his feet in the blood of the wicked. Take that literally at Armageddon, or symbolically in a lot of cases. So that a man shall say, verily there is a reward for the righteous. So sooner or later men are going to realize that. Verily he is the God that judges in the earth. You know, someone asked Abe Lincoln how long he thought the Civil War would go on. He said, well, I imagine, knowing the way God is, that until all the blood shed on all those ships bringing all those slaves over has been atoned for, we're going to have a war. People accused him of being irreligious or unchurched. And he was unchurched. You know, he just believed you need a book. You didn't need to go to church. You know, they've accused a lot of people of that. Psalm 59. Here again is another memorial melody of David. When Saul sent and they're watching the house to kill him. So this series of persecution psalms all runs in here together, and they're good to remember. So when you get persecuted or feel distraught or kind of upset at the persecutors, then just whip these open and read them, and you don't feel like the Lone Ranger anymore, you know. Deliver me from mine enemies, O my God. Now here again, if you want to turn back and read the accounting of what brought this psalm, you might jot down at the top of your chapter here, 1 Samuel 19, verses 10 through 17. Then you can read the story of what was going on, and then you can read this and get David's heart in the story. Deliver me from mine enemies, O my God. Set me on high from them that rise up against me. There again, that's what the word defend means. Get you up out of their reach. Set you on high. You're in God's hands. How can they touch you? Deliver me from the workers of iniquity. Save me from bloody men. Lo, they lie in wait for my soul. The mighty are gathered against me. Other kings, other chief leaders, not for my transgression, nor for my sin, O Eternal. They run and prepare themselves without my fault. Awake to help me, and behold. Now, of course, Saul admitted later that David was more righteous than he was. David hadn't been out trying to kill him at all. David respected and honored the position he was in. You, therefore, O Lord, O eternal God of hosts, the God of Israel, awake to visit all the heathen. Don't be full of mercy to any wicked transgressors. Selah. They return at evening. They make a noise like a dog, go around about the city. You notice how that word Selah always divides the story, where he gives you his feelings, and then he comes to that break, and then he comes right back and picks up, like back up at verse 1 and starts his story again. They return at evening. They make a noise like a dog, go around about the city like devouring wolf pack. Behold, they belch out with their mouth, swords are in their lips. Who, they say, does hear? But you, O Eternal, you're going to laugh at them. Now, you know, God does laugh. Now, he may not laugh in the same way a lot of humans laugh, but he does laugh at feasts, and God laughs at other things too. But one place God laughs, we don't. He always knows the end from the beginning. You know? He knows the outcome. So when persecutors are sure, boy, they've got that man of God, God just laughs. Because God knows he's got angels about that Son of God, and they're not going to touch him. They just think they are. You, O Eternal, you're going to laugh at him. You're going to have all the heathen in derision. Because of his strength, I'll wait upon you, for God is my high place. Here again, the terminology of security, of a high place. The God of my mercy shall prevent me. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that. It means protect and deliver. God shall let me see my desire on mine enemies. Slay them not, lest my people forget. Scatter them by your power, and bring them down, O Lord, our shield. For the sin of their mouth and the words of their lips, let them even be taken in their pride, for cursing and lying which they speak. Consume them in wrath, consume them, that they may not be. Let them know that God rules in Jacob to the ends of the earth. Now, there's probably a millennial verse. In another sense, you could say God rules in his people and delivers them in a single individual case. Verse 11 of chapter 58 could either be a millennial verse or else it might be individual verse in our day for the church. Back to verse 14. And at evening, going back to verse 6 about these devouring persecutors like a pack of dogs returning at evening. So now he parallels that with verse 14. And at evening, let them return. Let them make a noise like a dog and go around about the city. Let them wander up and down for meat and grudge if they be not satisfied. I'm not going to worry about it anymore, God. I'm just going to sing of your power. Yea, I'm going to sing aloud of your mercy in the morning, because you've been my defense. You've been my refuge in the day of my trouble. Unto you, O my strength, I'll sing, because God's my defense and the God of my mercy. Now, in the same context, we have to finish number 60, because this is at the same time, during the same events, except now instead of being on the run, being persecuted, and a bunch of dogs out like a pack devouring, now the war reverses itself, and you have a turnaround, and now all of a sudden, notice what David says to the chief musician upon Shushan-Yudith, that goes up above. Then this is, once again, a golden psalm, a miktam of David. Here's when he was striving with these two men that Joab had there. Joab returned and smote of Edom in this valley of salt, 12,000. So now he celebrates the victory. So here you have a victory psalm of the war having turned around, and now David all of a sudden is the victor. Oh God, you've cast us off. You've scattered us. You've been displeased. Oh, turn yourself to us again. You've made the earth to tremble. You've broken it. Heal the breaches thereof, for it shakes. Now, of course, this could be duality with the end time when the earthquakes come and Israel is cast off and scattered like David's forces were because of God being displeased and asking God to turn it around. The earth quakes and trembles. It's broken because of all the corruption and evil on it. You've showed your people hard things. You've made us to drink the wine of astonishment. So we drink that cup of that woman back in Revelation that's going to have the plagues come on them. You've given a banner to them that fear you, that it may be displayed because of the truth. So now he begins to talk about the turnaround and the banner of deliverance, that your beloved may be delivered, save with your right hand and hear me. God has spoken in his holiness. I'll rejoice. I'll divide Shechem and mete out the valley of Succoth. Gilead is mine, Manasseh is mine, Ephraim also is the strength of mine head. Judah is my lawgiver. So now in answer, of course this is again dual with Armageddon, and God is saying, wait a minute, look, I'm God, all this belongs to me. No enemy can do anything they please. I have to allow it or it couldn't be done. And I've allowed it for your chastening. But look, all of these areas belong to me. So God speaks up in his holiness. God's going to divide Shechem and mete out the valley of Succoth. And Moab is my washpot. Over Edom, I'm going to cast out my shoe. Philistia, I'm going to triumph over. Who will bring me into the strong city? Who will lead me into Edom? Will not you, O God, which have cast us off? So in reality, David's going to be there with God when he has that seventh trumpet sound and regathers Israel and begins the world of Mara government in the millennium, when Moab's the washpot and God casts out his shoe over Edom and triumphs over the Philistines, then God is going to bring David into the strong city of the world capital. God is going to lead David into Edom.
O God, you will, which have cast us off. You, O God, that didn't go out with our armies. You're going to give us help from trouble because we've depended on men and our loves and allies. Vain's the help of man. Through God, we'll do valiantly. It's He that's going to tread down our enemies. So after those psalms of humanity and psalms of persecution and pursuit and fleeing, all of a sudden you end the group with a victory song, the turnaround, and how God is going to change the thing. Well, we'll pick up with Psalm 61 next time then, and we should be able to scoot right along now. We have a number that aren't very long, and should finish them next time. And